Good afternoon or good morning, everyone, depending on where you're connecting from today. And welcome to the ADA Audio Conference Series, our session on December of 2013. This program is being brought to you by the ADA National Network. It's a collaborative of all of the 10 ADA centers across the country. This program has been in existence for more than 15 years now, and we do welcome you and are glad for those who have rejoined us from previous times and those that might be new to our program. We have people joining us today on the telephone as well as electronically through a webinar platform and such. So I'm just going to go through a few of the logistics so that everybody's on the same page of how we're going to manage today's session and the technology. And then we'll go ahead and introduce our speaker and get things started. So if you're listening today, it's being broadcast through your computer or via telephone. If you're using a computer, please make sure your speakers are turned on or your headphones are plugged in. You can control the audio via the audio and video panel at the top of your screen. You can adjust the sound by sliding the bar left or right. If you're experiencing any type of sound quality problems, please go through the audio wizard, which can be accessed by selecting the little microphone icon on the audio and video panel, and check your own settings on your computer. Often when we hear people having sound problems, it's typically because of something connected in their own system. We also have individuals connected today using mobile technologies, iPad, iPhones, Android devices, or Kindle Fire HD. Again, you may listen by downloading the Blackboard Collaborate mobile app. Please note, though, if you are using a mobile device, that closed captioning is not available on the mobile device, nor is some of the whiteboard content going to be problematic if you are using it for an accessibility purpose. Captioning is provided for today's session, and you can access that with the little CC icon at the top of the audio and video panel. Once you've selected that and opened a captioning window, you can change the font size, and you also have the option to save your transcript. We will be taking questions through the telephone today as well as through the webinar platform. Those of you on the telephone, our operator Stephanie will instruct you as to how to submit your questions when we get to that point. If you're on the webinar platform, please type your question into the chat area text box. If you're using a keyboard, it's Control-M or and enter your text in the chat area. You will not be able to see the question after you submit it, but it will be viewable by the presenters, and they will have access to that information. If you're connected via the mobile device, your questions will be submitted via the chat area within the mobile device. If you're on email or want to send by email, you can send it at webinars@ada-audio.org. And as was noted by Stephanie, the session is being recorded, and you'll be able to access it at the ADA Audio Conference website of www.ada-audio.org within 24 hours after the session. And we'll then have an edited transcript within 10 days after the session posted to the same website. You may also customize your view if you don't want to see all the little boxes and things. You can enlarge the whiteboard. There's a little drop-down box above the PowerPoint slide area that defaults as fit page. If you drop that down, you can see a number of different options you have. That will only change your view. It won't change anyone else's. You can also resize or reposition any of the boxes, chat, participant, or audio and video panels by detaching them or by using your mouse to reposition or stretch or shrink. Each panel can be detached using the little icon that I often refer to as lines on a paper in the upper right-hand corner of each panel. If you experience any technical difficulties today, telephone or webinar, if you're in the webinar platform, you can just send us a private message by choosing Great Lakes ADA in the list of participants and double-clicking on that, and a private box will appear. Or you can email by webinars@ada-audio.org or call our toll-free number at 877-232-1990, and our staff are more than happy to assist you. That's both voice and TTY. So now that I've completed all the logistical things for today's session, let's get on to the actual content and meat of it. So we are pleased today to have Sharon Renard, who is a senior attorney advisor with the ADA GINA division in the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, join us for what we call an open session of Ask the EEOC Questions and Answers. The intent of today's session is that you have an opportunity to ask the EEOC questions. They could be questions of something that's been burning on your mind for a while. It could be something that just happened yesterday, and it's a great time to be able to get some clarification of it. something that you read, an article, a press release, whatever else it might be, this is your opportunity to ask Sharon a question and get some feedback from her related to that particular issue. As I said earlier, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Sharon, and then Sharon will make a few comments, and we'll then have our operator give instructions on how to submit your questions. And as I said, anyone in the webinar platform can submit a question at any time. Sharon has been with the ADA division since 1992, so if you do your math back, that's right after the ADA was passed and the initial dates of implementation. She has served at one point as the acting director of the ADA division. She's also been responsible for developing or directing the many of the documents that have been created that help explain many of the aspects of the ADA, the technical assistance guidance documents, including sheets on telework, reasonable accommodations and such, and applications. She is a key drafter of some of those, and she specializes in providing employers with practical approaches to ADA compliance. She regularly consults with EEOC investigators and attorneys on ADA charges and litigation, and she works with the EEOC federal sector staff and administrative judges on the Rehabilitation Act complaints as well. She has written and delivered several ADA training programs for the EEOC staff, in addition to conducting numerous seminars, including been on this program many, many times, as well as the ADA National Symposium, and workshops for attorneys, human resource professionals, risk management personnel, and persons with disabilities. So at this time, I'm going to go ahead and turn over the microphone to Sharon. Sharon, go ahead.
Thank you, Robin, and welcome to everyone who is listening or participating today. And as Robin indicated, really this is your session more than it is our session or my session. I guess you all get to do some of the work today, because it is about your questions. When we were thinking about what to do today, given that EEOC has not recently put out any major documents, major interpretations of the employment provisions of the ADA recently, that we thought it would maybe be a good time to catch up with what is on your mind, as Robin said, and hear from you. So I hope you have come with questions today. And if you have heard me speak before, you know that I almost never can just say yes or no to answer a question, that they are always teaching vehicles, and I get to learn on behalf of my colleagues what's on your mind, what kinds of pressing issues, and we use that in helping us determine what kinds of future guidances we maybe should think about putting out there that you bring to our attention where there may be gaps in what people understand or where further clarification is needed. So you're really helping the EEOC, as well as I hope I can help some of you today. The one thing I will bring up, because we've been sort of waiting for something like this to come down, is that since the enactment of the ADA Amendments Act, the ADAAA, which, as everybody knows, went into effect back in 2009, and which expanded the definition of disability, we've certainly had court cases that have been coming down now, and as expected, most of those court cases have, as Congress intended, found a broader definition of disability. But those have been overwhelmingly district courts that have been issuing decisions, and we've been waiting to have an appellate court, you know, the level just below the Supreme Court, weigh in on their interpretation of the ADA Amendments Act. Well, as it happens, timing is everything. Yesterday, the Seventh Circuit, which is where Robin is, the Seventh Circuit, which encompasses the states of Illinois, Wisconsin, Indiana, maybe leaving one out, but I think those are the major ones, did issue a decision yesterday, and we're very pleased here at the EEOC with it. The case, and I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce the plaintiff's name, is Gogos, G-O-G-O-S, that's S as in Susan, versus AMS, S again as in Susan, AMS Mechanical Systems. And the sole focus of yesterday's decision was the ADA Amendments Act and whether the plaintiff's medical conditions rose to the level of being a disability. The district court had said no, they did not, dismissed it on that basis. Basically, it involves a form of hypertension that has had some impact on vision for this individual. And what the Seventh Circuit did in really only a couple of pages, it's a pretty straightforward decision, is they took various provisions of the ADA Amendments Act and they put it all together and they said, yes, this person, contrary to what the district court had ruled, can make out a case that he has a disability. And among the Amendments Act provisions that the Seventh Circuit focused on, first of all, they focused on the fact that his condition is episodic, and so they looked at that provision of the Amendments Act that said, you know, conditions that are episodic can be covered as long as when they are active, they substantially limit a major life activity, and the Seventh Circuit noted, episodic conditions don't have to be active for that great long a period of time. It might be a pretty brief period when they're active. Nonetheless, that still can trigger coverage under the ADA. They looked at two different major life activities. One was seeing, as I mentioned, this individual did have some vision problems, but they also looked at the major bodily function of the circulatory system. And they didn't really go into any great commentary, but again, what I think is notable is that the Seventh Circuit sort of accepted, you know, circulatory system clearly under the EEOC regulations. That's a major life activity. The court also looked at mitigating measures, noting that this individual took medication, as do many people who have hypertension, high blood pressure. And so they reviewed that we have to ignore, the court said, any positive effects from the medication. So if you take that into account, that was like another reason to say, yes, this is a disability. And perhaps, to my mind, most significantly, the court said the fact that the employer may have made an argument that maybe these conditions really weren't going to last all that long. And the court said that in its reading of the ADA Amendments Act, the EEOC's regulations of the Act, they said, it doesn't have to last a long period of time. And they quote from the appendix to the EEOC regulations, which state that the language we find in the regarded as definition of disability, where you can't fall under regarded as if the condition at issue is transitory and minor, and transitory meaning 6 months or less, the court rejected the employer's argument that that applies to determining coverage under the first definition as to whether or not someone's substantially limited. They said, we don't look at that 6 months and the minor language. That doesn't apply here. And they said, in fact, as the appendix to the regulations make clear, it might last less than 6 months and still be considered a disability. And I think that's a point that many people raise over and over again. How long does something have to last? And still I hear as I travel around the country people saying, but doesn't it have to last at least 6 months or more? And the Seventh Circuit made very clear, echoing the EEOC, no, that is not a requirement to be a substantially limiting impairment. So that to me was perhaps the most significant part of the decision. But I do call it to people's attention. It really is one of the very first appellate court decisions interpreting the Amendments Act, doing, I think, exactly what Congress wanted to see happen here. So if you follow these things, then this is a decision that you'll want to note. And it is from a circuit court of appeals that does have a lot of influence. People do look towards the Seventh Circuit. It is considered an authoritative circuit. So really something that they came out this way. So that's my introduction. But at this point, Robin, I'd like to throw it open to the audience, and whether it's on specific issues or something about the EEOC and what's going on here, I'm happy to do my best to provide answers.
Great. Well, thank you, Sharon, for that great introduction. And you are right. Timing is everything. And so it's great to be able to hear about that case and the implications of that case, especially, as you said, being a circuit-level case. So, Stephanie, I'm going to ask you if you would just give some instructions to our participants as to how they can submit questions via the telephone. That would be great.
Ladies and gentlemen on the phone lines, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key.
Great. And while we're waiting for people on the phone to queue up, we do have some questions that have been submitted electronically, so I'll start there. We have a question which is, when might we expect the long-awaited guidance on leave as a reasonable accommodation to come out from the EEOC?
I wish I could give you a definitive answer to that question, and it is not the first time that we've heard this question. I know that the commissioners, gosh, I lose track of time, but we're probably going back a couple of years now. They held a well-publicized meeting on the issue of leave as a form of reasonable accommodation, and indicated in that meeting that they wanted to issue guidance, and I'm well aware to date that we do not have it. And I mean, the best I can say is that don't be looking for anything imminently, meaning before the end of this year or January. We're not going to have anything coming out that soon. I think it is still on the commissioner's to-do list. They know that there are a lot of concerns and issues around leave as a reasonable accommodation, that employers and employees seeking more information on all kinds of leave issues, on people who need what might be called intermittent leave, that they need a few days here, a few days there. Sometimes it's on a regular basis, or it can be predicted. Other times, depending on the disability, it may be unpredictable. Just the only predictability is that there will be that kind of leave. Then there are people who need a huge block of time to take off. Obviously, that's a little more definitive in terms of the period, but sometimes that can be extended. And what starts out is perhaps 3, 4, 5 months, and then there's a request for an extension of leave. And the issues that employees and employers have, how much leave can people take? How many extensions might people be eligible for? And so the commission is continuing to look into these issues to see if we can put something together. And I know that's an unsatisfactory answer, but unfortunately it is the best that I can give at this time. Certainly if there are questions today dealing with leave issues, I'm more than happy to try to answer them. The thing that I will say is that what I do, what the rest of the staff here in the ADA division continue to emphasize to employers and employees, no matter what the leave situation is, the importance of the interactive process, the communication between employee and employer. And that, you know, really employers need to be clear about why leave is needed, how much leave is needed, that if we're talking about a block of time, that employers should, as the end of that period approaches, be checking in if they haven't already. Is everything on schedule for somebody to come back? And if not, if things have changed, then there needs to be a dialogue about that, and potentially employees will need to be prepared providing additional medical documentation about the extension. On the other side, employees, don't wait for the call from the employer. That we very strongly encourage employees, while they're on leave, no matter what kind, stay in touch with the employer. Bring them up to date about developments, what's going on, why things may have changed from what was initially thought. Again, medical science is not always going to lend itself to absolute predictability. Things can change for many reasons, and so what was once thought of as, say, you know, someone will be out for 4 months, why they're now saying they're going to need perhaps an additional 2 months of leave. But the sooner that employer and employee can talk about those issues, that employers are entitled to get up-to-date information to understand where things are, and again, it's that they should both be attempting to keep those lines of communication open and to have a free transfer of very relevant information, that these things can go far more smoothly than, you know, employers shouldn't wait till the day before leave is ending to make contact. Employees should not be waiting. The sooner these things are talked about, the better they might go. But I'll leave it here and see if, you know, we do have some people this afternoon who have some specific questions on leave.
Great. Thank you. So I have a question then, then we'll go to the phone and see what we have. There's someone who has submitted a question is saying that, asking me basically, why are lawyers, and this person saying in a certain region, and I believe this person is from the Ohio area, failing to pursue violations of EOC laws for people who are unemployed. This person saying specifically that they were asked by an attorney, you know, what do you project your income loss to be because of unemployment, and the person said, well, I don't have any projected loss because I don't have a job. I can't get hired because of my disability. And we hear this on occasion, this continued issue of attorneys being, you know, leery to take ADA cases, and some of it is obviously some of the things that happened pre-ADA Amendments Act. But do you see any trends of changing at all in increased number of cases being taken, or any thoughts on that issue, Sharon?
In terms of lawyers who may be reluctant to take a case on behalf of somebody with a disability, first of all, it can be difficult at times from working here in Washington, D.C., to really have a sense nationwide about what's happening. It just is not always easy to tell. So I certainly don't want to hold myself out as somebody who can offer definitive or special insight into the question that has been raised here. Certainly, as you indicated, Robin, this concern, complaint is not new, and certainly prior to the ADA Amendments Act, what we thought we understood from a lot of plaintiff's attorneys, the attorneys who would represent someone with a disability, was that given it was so difficult to prove disability in a court of law, that was a big reason that many lawyers were reluctant to take such cases, and therefore one hoped with the ADA Amendments Act, where disability was not going to be as big an issue anymore, and that the focus could be on the alleged discrimination, that may make it easier for plaintiff's attorneys to take the case. In terms of the question that was posed about someone being asked about their financial losses, the reason attorneys are going to ask that is that for them, they don't necessarily have deep pockets, and they have to make some very hard decisions about what cases to take, and so clearly they're looking to see how successful it would appear a given case is. Obviously, there's a lot of expense in bringing a lawsuit, and not just about the lawyer. I mean, for the individual who wants to pursue this, they're putting a lot on the line financially for it. And so one of the things that a lawyer might well look at is, if we win the case, what would be the damages? What are the financial losses here that can be claimed? And that can vary enormously. Some cases there really is almost no financial damage at all. Others it can be quite significant. And how easy or not easy it is to compute, well, lawyers should be able to help with that. I mean, in terms of, well, I didn't get the job and I haven't been able to find work for a while. I mean, those are things that shouldn't be surprising to a lawyer. These are things they ought to be able to work with in terms of calculations. But it may influence, again, whether rightly or wrongly, a lawyer's willingness to take on a certain case. I don't have any terrific insights on how to find attorneys. I mean, what I tell people is get in touch with local bar associations, and specifically looking for people who do employment law, civil rights law. That I always tell individuals, you need to interview the lawyer just as much as the lawyer's interviewing you. And one of the things that you want to know is not just that they have a specialty in employment law or even civil rights law, but what about the ADA? Or for those of you coming from states that have disability discrimination laws, and sometimes those are very excellent laws and offer a lot of protection. So something else to be asking a lawyer, what their experience is with those laws, because having experience handling civil rights in general is not the same as having experience handling the ADA or the state counterparts to the ADA. And so you really want to make sure that a lawyer that might be willing to take your case is someone who has some background and understanding about this, and that in effect you don't necessarily want someone who's going to be learning on the job and who really may not have had as much experience. Calling local disability organizations, especially ones that have legal offices themselves. Many disability organizations, and if you don't necessarily have one in your local area, then the state, or a national organization. National organizations tend to have connections throughout the country. And oftentimes the legal office may only be part of the national organization, not necessarily smaller state or regional offices. But if they have a legal office, you want to talk to that lawyer. First of all, some disability organizations have networks of lawyers who are interested in taking on cases. And so if you're lucky, you may get plugged into that kind of network. If they don't have a formal network, they still may have some contacts, and if they do in your particular state or city or locality, then again, this is a head start, a way to kind of get to attorneys who may know something about your disability as well as the ADA. So I'm afraid it will take a bit of effort on the part of individuals with disabilities in terms of tracking someone down. Obviously, there are timelines for filing lawsuits, and so, you know, what I've often told employees, if you've got a case pending at the EEOC, or if your case is pending at one of the sister agencies, state agencies that are comparable to the EEOC, you may never need to get a lawyer. Maybe it will all be resolved through the EEOC or one of our sister agencies. But that's not a bad time to start doing some investigating, simply because once, if the EEOC does decide not to litigate your case, then you do have only a certain amount of time if you want to file a lawsuit to do so. And that isn't going to give you as much time if that's when you start your search for an attorney. So maybe you'll never need the attorney, but it may not be a bad idea while your case is still sitting at EEOC, the timeline hasn't started running yet, that if you even think that may be something you're going to feel strongly about, that you want to start doing some investigation, start getting some names, not a bad idea to do it at that point.
Great.
Back to you, Robin.
Yep. Thank you. Do we have any questions from the telephone?
I'm currently showing no questions from the phone lines.
They're a silent group today, huh? Okay, we've got some questions submitted electronically. We'll keep going with then. We have a question related to accommodations here. So when reassignment is used as a reasonable accommodation, how does the EEOC define a quote-unquote open funded position? Is it more than just those positions that are in preparation to be completed?
I may need clarification on this one, Robin, because I'm not sure that I know what exactly is meant, maybe you do, by an open funded position.
I believe that it's that they're interpreting that as being a position that is currently open and that it has got money to be able to hire versus a position that I might have, but I am frozen it, or, you know, because of no funding available.
Okay. Well, I will go on that basis, and please, whoever asked the question, if we're wrong about this, please write us back. But in terms of reassignment and looking for an appropriate vacant position, what we have certainly said informally, this is not addressed directly in the Commission's guidance on reasonable accommodation, but really we think flows from it, is that you are looking for vacant positions that, as an employer, you are intending to fill them. That to the extent you have a position on the books, but at this point in time, you are not intending to fill it. And by this point in time, I don't mean we're not filling it this week, we're going to fill it next month. That's still a position that the EEOC would readily say you have to consider for reassignment. What I'm talking about are positions that, look, right now, for example, in the federal government, most federal agencies have some type of hiring freeze going on, and that means that on the books they may have a position, but at this time with a hiring freeze they have absolutely no authority to fill it. And they hope that there will be better days, more appropriations coming at some point, which is why they don't take the position off the books. It still exists if you look at personnel records, but there's no money in the budget to go ahead and hire at this time. So we would not say that's a position that an agency would have to look at if it's looking for vacant positions to make a reassignment. Similarly, in the private sector, there may be reasons that on the personnel or human resources roster, you see certain positions, or it could be in state and local government agencies. There could be positions that you see on the books. But at this point in time, for whatever kind of financial or other reasons, there will be no hiring into that slot, then that is not considered a vacant position for reassignment purposes. The employer would not have to consider that an open slot and think about it for reassigning an employee with a disability. It needs to be a position that the employer is intending to fill, maybe not this week or next, but if the employer knows that in fairly short order, yes, we're going to advertise it. If we haven't already, obviously if they've already started advertising for it, well, then that's a position they're intending to fill. But if it's simply we haven't written up the new job description, we haven't gotten around to advertising it, or for some employers it may be, look, we're almost at the end of a calendar year, our next financial year begins January 1, we are not going to advertise until the new fiscal year begins January 1. That would be considered a vacant position, even though today, you know, I might be searching for a possible reassignment today on December 17th. Okay, fine, you don't intend to actively look to fill it till January 1. That's in basically a couple of weeks. we're not asking you to necessarily put the person in before January 1, but that would be a position that an employer would have to look at. Back to you, Robin.
Great. Well, thank you. That's a very thorough. Sometimes you think, well, you just read that one little question and, you know, can get much more involved. But I do have to tell you that the person that you that had asked that question did respond back saying that that you answered it the question for them. So we obviously interpreted that hopefully correctly.
As I said to people, I don't give brief answers. So as long as you all do your part and ask questions, we'll get through these 90 minutes.
There's an individual who's asking a follow-up to the earlier question that we had when you were asked about the quote-unquote long-awaited leave guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's asking, are there any other updates of existing publications or any new guidances in the works other than that leave guidance that you would be able to speak to?
In terms of documents that EEOC has fairly recently released and hopes to release some more in the new year, one of our long-delayed projects is updating, in light of the ADA Amendments Act, all our documents to reflect the enactment of the ADA Amendments Act, and that's long overdue. And finally, this past summer, four of our disability documents, and of course I will probably get them wrong, but we had, I think, diabetes, cancer, epilepsy, and I think it was intellectual disabilities were the four that were updated this past summer. And so if you go to our website, now you see those documents updated to reflect the passage of the ADA Amendments Act. We have several more that are in the pipeline. They I expect they will be issued in 2014, hopefully not too far into the new year. We don't tend to talk about which ones are coming out until they do, because it really is up to the commissioners to make that approval. But these are fairly far along in the pipeline. So I expect in the early months of 2014, some more of these documents will be updated. In terms of guidances, which tend to focus not on disabilities but on particular issues, on particular issues, and I can talk about it only because it was commissioners have talked publicly about something, then I'm sort of a little freer to. Otherwise, again, and it's more about not raising people's hopes, like with the leave document. If you talk about things and then they don't come out, people obviously are mystified and confused. So that's often a reason we don't try to talk about things that are in the pipeline. But one area that's being looked at and has been looked at again for a very long time are the issue of wellness programs, which have become extraordinarily popular with employers, very important. They take all kinds of forms, these wellness programs, and some of them employers have incorporated or tried to incorporate as part of health insurance that they provide. And there have been many issues on the ADA implications of these programs, not least of which have been the question of these programs are often said to be voluntary. But what does that mean? Because if they are involuntary, if employers really are being made to participate in a wellness program, those are generally considered medical exams. And as probably everybody knows, the ADA does regulate an employer's ability to require employees to undergo medical exams. Not impossible for an employer to require a medical exam, but an employer's required to show the business necessity of it. And this is an area that, again, probably requires more clarification than EEOC has provided. Courts have really not delved into this issue much. And so that's a reason that there has been a longstanding request to the EEOC, can we come forth with more information? At what point does participation in a wellness program move from being purely voluntary, in which case there's no ADA implication, it's voluntary, to know something the employer is really requiring. And this can involve issues, for example, employers who might say, we'll give you a t-shirt if you will participate in this voluntary wellness program. Does that mean that it's not voluntary because they're holding out that they're going to give you something in exchange? Is a t-shirt making it into an involuntary medical exam? More to the point, perhaps, were those employers who might say, we will change your health insurance premium. We may require you to pay less for your health insurance if you participate. Otherwise, you know, we'll start at everybody, say, pays $100 a month, but if you participate, we'll drop it to $50 a month. Well, does that influence an employee to the point where it isn't really voluntary, that's sort of real money to people? And so it's really, in a way, requiring people to sign up. So these issues, the Commission well aware of them. Commission has spent a lot of time discussing them. Commission has had a meeting, a public meeting on it. And again, I think that the Commission is looking to put something out in this area. Again, please don't look for it in the next couple of weeks or couple of months. But I think that there is a recognition that it's gotten to the point the Commission needs to sort of highlight that particular issue and the ADA implications of it. So that's probably leapfrogged over some other issue areas as one that really does require something from the Commission. But again, unless and until the commissioners put something out, that's when you will know, is when they put something out that's there. But beyond that, no, I really can't say. But again, always open, and you can do it through the ADA centers. Anything that you are interested in the commission addressing, we certainly would appreciate hearing what issues are on your mind that, you know, we might do documents on. You're welcome to send something into the EEOC saying we really wish you would put something out on whatever issue. Robin?
Yeah, great. So thank you. I'm going to go back to the phone, see if there's anything that is coming on the phone before I go back to the electronic.
We do have a question from Rick Edwards. Your line is open.
Hi, Sharon. Hi, Robin. My question revolves around reasonable accommodations, and I'd like for you to discuss a little bit about an ADA coordinator following up, asking about medical information, what kind of information can or should that individual ask for and ask about and not ask about, and what would you say would be a reasonable time to respond?
Okay, a reasonable time for the employee to respond to the query?
No, sorry, for the accommodation to be provided from start to finish, the whole process.
Well, these are all going to be really hard to answer without, and certainly I don't want us to spend half an hour on a specific question if there's a bit more to it. But in terms of asking for more medical information, it really depends on what it is that is already known. If, for example, if the disability is already known to the employer, then asking for medical documentation should not be happening because that's already something that the employer knows about. Instead, what the employer may not know about is, yeah, you have a disability, but I don't understand why you need reasonable accommodation at all, or why you need the specific accommodation that you are saying you need. It's not A and B, you must have C as your accommodation. That can be where the employer would be entitled to say, I would like to get medical documentation that supports that request. But again, you know, it's all dependent on what it is that the employer already knows to begin with, remembering that what should really happen first is some sort of discussion directly with the individual before any medical documentation is requested, is having a conversation, asking questions of the applicant or the employee, depending on who's making the request for accommodation. Sometimes there may not be any need for medical documentation. The conversation may establish what the employer needs to know. Other times, no, the employer wants something substantiated, like employer may say, fine, you've got a hidden disability, but I would still like to have something that just confirms it. And that doesn't necessarily require much effort, or we're not talking about 10 pages of documentation, maybe a simple one or two sentences that yes is confirming the individual has a certain disability. There may be more documentation, more need for explanation as to why an accommodation is needed. And in terms of your second question about how long the whole process should take, or how long should it take to provide an accommodation, again, without more specifics, I mean, in some instances, I might answer it should take no more than a few days. In others, it might be a few months if it's something that needs to be purchased or leased or ordered and it's not readily available. An employer has checked with all the places in terms of where they might get something, then it may take more time than anybody would like, but that's, you know, there's very little the employer can do. Other times it may be that this kind of communication that goes back and forth may take, again, you know, sometimes it may just be a matter of days, sometimes weeks. Maybe we're going to get into a couple of months, I don't know. On both sides, what I would always strongly encourage is that this should be a priority for employers and for individuals with disabilities to respond as quickly as possible if an employer is seeking medical documentation. That I know people's doctors are very, very busy. This may not be a high priority, but as the patient, you're in a better position to plead, nag, whatever, to get the doctor as quickly as possible to respond to the employer's questions. And for employers that, again, as I say, obviously many things are going on, lots of things to do, but when people make requests for accommodation, it should be considered a priority. And to be informing each other where things are. If an individual is trying to get information from the doctor, let the employer know that you're doing things, that what it is you're trying. I left my third message today, that kind of thing. And for employers, very important to keep the individual in the loop. What are you doing? If it's about having to consult, hey, we need to call the Job Accommodation Network. And so we left a message and they're going to get back to us. You know, keeping people informed of the efforts that you're making, what you're doing, why something may be taking longer. No individual wants to feel the employer's not paying attention. And I've certainly seen many instances where employers are doing quite a bit, but they're forgetting to keep the individual in the loop. And so the individual is thinking, you're just ignoring me. And so it is important, keep the person in the loop. But again, you know, that's probably about as definitive as I can get without having any more specific information.
It's all good information and good to hear that clarified. One of my big concerns in this situation was that the ADA coordinator was saying that they believe that they have a disability, but they want to get more information about the disability itself before they determine whether or not the accommodation that's being requested is in fact reasonable. And this, you know, has taken at least a year or more.
All right. Well, things that have stretched on for a year are a bit of a concern. And you can go back and say, you know, Sharon Renner to the EEOC said so. Now, you know, maybe the person can come up with some good reasons, but things shouldn't be taking that long. And it's not good for the employee, and it's not good for the employer. And again, since you're using the term coordinator, I'm assuming, and I may be wrong in this assumption, we're talking about a state agency. Are we?
No.
Oh. Okay, because that's often a term used for people working within state agencies trying to get accommodations.
Right.
But for any employer, it's that that should not be, and this should be an outlier. If it's going to take a year, and I mean, I hate to ever say, that's wrong, but that should be a real outlier. And I can, it's very hard to think of a situation where on the employer's side, now again, if the employee has dropped the ball and that's contributed to this, again, without, this is all very much about specific facts, and you can't always tell, did somebody drop the ball? And sometimes I've seen it's the employee dropped the ball. And maybe there were reasons. Something else came up, employee couldn't get back to an employer, okay. But if that went on for several months, well, that's not something that we'd say would be the fault of the employer. But this goes back to why it needs to be a priority, and it isn't good to drag these things out. It can make things worse, especially if the accommodation is needed to do the job. Then the longer it takes, then we're talking about somebody who potentially isn't performing the job as they should be doing, as expected. And that's not a situation that anybody should want, least of all an employer. So, sometimes there are extenuating circumstances, but there really should be, if it's been a year, people meeting again, what's going on, where have things bogged down, what do we need to do to get out of this logjam? Because it should be moving. And again, what employers risk at this point is somebody who says after a year, in essence, it's like you're saying no, and they file complaints and charges of violating the ADA. And we see that every day at the EEOC. There was never a formal decision to say no. But at some point where the process is just dragging on, and certainly where it's the employer, okay, not the employee who's dropped the ball, but the employer, the employer is going to have some very tough questions coming from the EEOC about why it dragged on, why it dropped the ball, why, and saying, well, but we haven't said no. EEOC has found employers liable for not providing accommodation in just those circumstances, and saying, but we never said no. Yeah, essentially you did by not acting on it. And if we find there was a reasonable accommodation, and obviously we have to find there was a reasonable accommodation possible that would not have caused undue hardship, then we do find employers liable. So there is a risk when these things drag on, certainly from the employer's legal standpoint. So,
all right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. Good discussion. We will move on to another question that we had that was submitted electronically. Could you speak a little bit about the issue of medical marijuana and where it fits in relationship to employment and in medical inquiry, et cetera, as well as drug-related issues, given that many more states are now passing laws both for medical marijuana but also recreational marijuana?
Yes. What I can tell you is that whether a state is adopting laws approving the medical use of marijuana or the recreational use of marijuana, under federal law, the use of marijuana continues to be illegal. And that is what controls in terms of the ADA. The ADA does not reference or is not influenced by state law, but by federal law. And so as long as marijuana is considered an illegal substance under federal law, it is an illegal drug for ADA purposes, which means that an employer that finds out you are using marijuana recreationally, medically, lawful in your state, but it is legal under federal law, if the employer fires you for that reason, because you're using marijuana, you can't, you're not going to have an ADA claim there. It's not protected by the ADA. If your state law protects you from being terminated, that's a different matter, but you can't use the ADA. If you fail a drug test, the marijuana shows up. Well, I'm taking it, and it's lawful here in my particular state, you can say, whether, again, medical use or recreational use, nonetheless, illegal under federal law. So doing the drug test was lawful, now acting on the results of it. You tested positive for marijuana. You are positive for marijuana use. Again, if the employer terminates you, ADA isn't going to help. So we get this question a lot because, as you noted, Robin, more states are making it lawful, at least under certain circumstances, to use marijuana. We are aware of it. But there's absolutely nothing in the ADA to take cognizance of that. And so individuals using marijuana need to keep in mind, and we've had a lot of people who've been caught unawares and they've suffered consequences for it in terms of their employers, that the ADA isn't going to offer protection to them.
Is there any plan or anything that the EOC is doing to put any kind of statement out or clarification of that particular issue, given that you've indicated you guys are hearing it, we're hearing it out in the field? Is there any, as you edit or do anything with documents, putting that as a Q&A or in putting in specific guidance or anything out on that issue?
That I can't say.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to go back to see if there are any more telephone before I go back to electronic.
I'm currently showing no questions at this time.
Okay. We have a question that was submitted electronically related to obesity. Let me read through it here. I heard Chairwoman Chai Feldblum discussed in an interview the issue of obesity in the ADA. I had several questions at the end of her interview. Can you please clarify when, quote unquote, obesity is a disability and how that analysis is made? By the discussion that Chai Feldblum had, it appeared to me that the position of the EEOC on obesity had changed.
Well, first of all, I'm not necessarily familiar with the particular interview, so I can't react to exactly what Commissioner Feldblum may or may not have said. I can tell you that nothing has changed in terms of EEOC's position. That is that, first of all, as always with finding a disability, you start with an impairment. And an impairment can be a condition known as morbid obesity. This was true before the ADA amendments. It's true after the ADA amendments. Morbid obesity, basically in its simplest terms, is where for your gender, your weight, your height, you know, what the kind of standard weight should be. Obviously, there's a range. It's not one particular weight. But when you're basically twice what your weight ought to be for your gender, your height, then that's where we're looking at an impairment. And then, as with any impairment, has to substantially limit a major life activity. Now, what many of us have said, and this may have been what Commissioner Feldblum was indicating, as a result of the ADA Amendments Act, it may be easier for people with morbid obesity, that's the impairment, to show substantial limitation in a major life activity as a result of the impairment. Prior to the Amendments Act, that was often difficult. Just because you had morbid obesity didn't mean it was necessarily easy to show substantial limitation in a major life activity. Now it may be easier to do so, not least because of the category of major bodily functions. If you have all that extra weight, it may be impacting things like the circulatory system, to name just one potential major bodily function one might look at. So it could well be that Commissioner Feldblum was making the point that a lot of us have made, that it is possible more people with morbid obesity may indeed be covered under the ADA now, thanks to the Amendments Act. Simply being a bit overweight, no. I mean, that in and of itself is still not going to be an impairment. And if we don't have an impairment, then we can't have a disability. So that's not changed. And again, the Amendments Act didn't change that. So we still have to have the predicate, if you will, of finding an impairment. But there has been no change in how we are approaching the weight issues, if you will. It is really more the idea that more people with morbid obesity, as with other impairments, thanks to the Amendments Act, more people may indeed have coverage. And of course, if they have coverage, then protection against discrimination on the basis of that disability, potentially a right to a reasonable accommodation, all the things that flow from having a disability.
Great, thank you. I know that was kind of a loaded one. All right, I'll take another one from our electronic submissions. This is a question related specifically to Section 503. And the question is, what is the EEOC doing, if anything, to work with the Office of Federal Contract Compliance to address ADA as it relates to Section 503 compliance? Is there any collaboration taking place at this time? That's the question.
Well, I don't know if we have collaboration at this time. Certainly, the EEOC and the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, I'll say OFCCP now, easier, do collaborate, do have discussions. Certainly, OFCCP's recent enactment of new 503 regulations, there was consultation between the two agencies when they were developing the regulations before they put it out for notice and comment. After notice and comment, there were still discussions. So the extent in terms of overlap, obviously there are many things that Section 503 does that is way beyond EEOC's jurisdiction, and that's strictly up to OFCCP. But to the extent there are any things that could implicate the enforcement of the ADA, our agencies certainly do have discussions. I know that at one point there was concern, and I don't know if the questioner has this in mind, but at one point there was concern that the new Section 503 regulations in terms of dealing with affirmative action, which is something that falls under 503, not the ADA, but in terms of affirmative action, the new 503 regulations were proposing that contractors be asking questions in terms of seeing if the potential applicants were people with disabilities and therefore entitled to affirmative action efforts, and employers were concerned that that might end up making the contractor, the employer, violate the ADA, because they said, hey, wait a minute, under ADA, we're not supposed to be asking about disability pre-offer. And here's OFCCP and its proposed regulations and now final regulations basically saying, yeah, we're supposed to ask these questions. And so the legal counsel of the EEOC sent a letter, a public letter, to OFCCP to address just this point. This was the collaboration between the agencies. We were made aware of employer concerns, and we wanted to put their minds at rest. And so basically what this letter says, and you can find the letter on the OFCCP website. It's part of where they deal with the new 503 regulations, that the legal counsel of the EEOC said, no, we don't see any potential ADA violation if you indeed adopt this regulation and require your contractors to seek out disability information, whether someone has a disability. They can still be in compliance with the ADA. Why is that so? It's the EEOC's guidance published in the mid-1990s on the pre-employment process and asking questions about disability. And in that guidance, which is on the EEOC website, we have a whole section on affirmative action, and not just about 503, but any kind of affirmative action, in which we said if the employer follows certain common sense basic rules, which we laid out, then they have every right to ask, do you have a disability for affirmative action purposes? Now, we said, you know, you can't use that to start asking two pages of questions, you know, so how did your disability occur? How long have you had it? I mean, no, those would be questions that would violate the ADA, but you don't need all that information if your objective is to see if somebody should be considered for affirmative action efforts. And we said, you know, you have to put it on a separate form, separate from the rest of the application. The idea being that perhaps you have any number of people who will look at an application, but a far more limited group who will look at the affirmative action information you're acquiring. You know, that those people alone will see the kind of, it can be a separate piece of paper or a tear-off sheet, but the idea is that goes to a far more limited group. It may be one person or two people, but people who are specifically authorized by the employer to see who should be considered for affirmative action. The fact that you have a dozen other people who may be checking on people's their resumes, their educational backgrounds, their work experience, but those are not people who are going to be part of deciding who is or is not eligible for affirmative action. Then that's why we say keep it separate. As long as you keep it separate, it's voluntary. It, you know, your form makes clear to applicants. You can, you know, choose to fill this out or not choose to fill it out. It doesn't affect your consideration for a job. The only way it's going to be used is going to be for affirmative action. You cannot use this information in any other way. So in the EEOC guidance from the mid-1990s, we dealt with this issue. And that's what this letter from the legal counsel to OFCCP referenced and reviewed and said, as long as all of this is complied with, then anything in the 503 regulation would not put the contractor in jeopardy, that compliance with 503 would not lead to a violation of the ADA. So as an example of the collaboration of the two agencies talking to each other, of trying to make sure we don't have employers caught between two federal agencies, that's the example I can offer there.
Great. That's great. Thank you very much. We'll go back and see if there's anything from the phone.
I'm currently showing no questions on the phone lines.
All right, I'll keep going with the electronics then. This is a question that came in. You'll think it's coming from me, but it's actually coming from somebody else because you've heard this from me many times, Sharon. The question is a statement, more and more employers are doing business electronically, including recruitment, applications, managing benefits, payroll information, et cetera. Many of these systems are inaccessible. Employers are offering employees options such as paper applications or setting up a meeting with HR to get information on benefits payroll. What is the line between an accommodation and what's not a reasonable accommodation when others are able to get the same information 24/7?
Yes, this is an issue, not just you, Robin, many have people. It's another one of those issues that I wish I could tell you that, you know, on this date, EEOC is going to address it. But this is something I appreciate because as soon as I get off, I get to say, once again, question has come in on the fact that, as you say, and as we're well aware, employers, you know, including the federal government, turning more and more to the use of electronic devices to convey information, to collect information, applications, recruitment, all these things, and once you're an employee, all the benefits, all the rest of it, absolutely. And the fact that there continue to be problems with accessibility. So I don't know, again, I can't tell you when EEOC may come out with something on this, as much as people would like to hear that. I can't say that at this point. What I can say in terms of the issue or the question that was raised about the line between reasonable accommodation to get access, but wait a minute, how close is that to what people without disabilities who can maybe access things 24/7? The way we started in terms of approaching this issue Certainly, you can look at it that if you're an applicant, you have to be able in a timely way to hear about job opportunities and to be able to apply, to get information. In other words, like somebody who doesn't have whatever the particular disability, that in real time, that you be able to have, if not identically the same opportunity, certainly substantially it must be there. By which I mean, for example, if everybody, let's say, yesterday was Monday and some job announcement went up, and so everybody had an opportunity to hear about it, and then due to a disability and it being inaccessible, that somebody may not hear about it till January 1. Well, wait a minute, that and the closing date's January 2nd for this job, that may be a problem. That in, when I talk about in real time, substantially getting people the same access to the information, that's obviously not even close. And so, if, where's the reasonable accommodation there? Now, if an employer is willing to give you the same amount of time as, whatever it is, about 2.5 weeks from December 16th to January 2nd, and, you hear about it on January 1st, and they're willing to extend just for you because that was the only way you were going to get the information, well, maybe that is the reasonable accommodation, and they have to give that application the same consideration. But obviously, employers aren't going to want to do that. So, one thing certainly that a lot of people have been trying to urge employers, there's no way to turn the tide back, things are going to go electronic, is for employers to really keep at the accessibility issue so we avoid these kinds of problems. If we do have these problems, then employers are going to have to do a lot. I think, basically saying, sorry, you just have to wait for the next job opportunity, that's not going to cut it. And I think a lot of employers are going to have to think of things like my example. You're just going to have to allow a tremendous extension for some people. And you've got to give it this, you're going to stop everything, and you're not going to move ahead and, all that inconvenience. Or what are you going to do to provide a system, and we don't like to see totally separate systems, but nonetheless, is there more that an employer can do so it doesn't have this issue? It isn't an easy line between, where's reasonable accommodation as opposed to access up front to things. One of the difficulties in this area is that the way the employment provisions of the ADA are written, it's really about employers reacting to requests for reasonable accommodation as opposed to the employment provisions of the ADA saying, employers, you must be proactive and you must put in place accessible things. It's a different approach than, say, we see in Title II and Title III of the ADA, where there are requirements to be more proactive, not to wait for somebody to highlight that there's an issue or a problem. Rather, in employment, employers can wait until somebody highlights a problem, but in this area, in a way, that may be too late. And we're aware that it may be too late to do something, which is the reason that there's kind of these two tracks running. And one is the track of getting employers to think proactively in terms of their electronics and everything they're doing and ways to improve accessibility, to work with many groups. The Access Board here in Washington, lots of information, lots of potential assistance in terms of other organizations like the ADA centers to help here, that it just will be less, when I talk to employers, I say, out of your own self-interest, less of a headache, because when you have to approach it as reasonable accommodation, you have to do it, and you may not be able to say it's an undue hardship. In fact, it may be hard to say it's an undue hardship, and yet what you may have to do could certainly be inefficient and slow down your process and all kinds of things, and yet you're not going to be able to argue that that is an undue hardship. So it's not the best solution, I grant you. For individuals with disabilities, I constantly am saying as soon as you hear about something, you know, get on it. If you work for an employer and things are inaccessible in terms of electronics, well, you're now on the inside and you should be working with them. And if they're not really responding, again, make it a request for accommodation. But then you file a charge that you are being denied, you know, I can't get access to my benefits like everybody else. I'm being made to wait. You know, I tell people it's an imperfect system and I don't want people to file a charge if I have to wait perhaps, you know, 24 hours longer than most people do. I think there you may just for a while have to accept, because I don't know that that's going to go anywhere. But where there really becomes a significant delay in getting information, I've told HR people and their IT people, this becomes the priority over everything else. If you have an inaccessible system, then somebody's making a request for accommodation to get access to something, I would make it the highest priority, because if you don't, then you may be in trouble with EEOC on how you handled that request for accommodation. So again, a way to kind of urge them, maybe you want to deal with your accessibility problem instead of having to, you know, constantly drop things and handle them as requests for accommodation, which is just frustrating for everybody. So a very imperfect answer to a very important and relevant question.
Very complex and lots of factors, so thank you. I'll go back to the telephone to see if there's any questions before I proceed with electronic.
Again, to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. And we do have a follow-up from Rick Edwards. Your line is open.
It's me again. It is not really a follow-up, a totally different situation, Sharon, and it may be a very short answer, but I thought I'd ask because we've still got an agency that's dealing with this. Blanket policy indicating that the individual has to have a 100% release to come back to work?
That's not good. blanket policy requiring that somebody be 100%, very dangerous, because that's absolutely excluding the possibility of reasonable accommodation. People do not have to be 100%. EEOC's guidance on workers' compensation issues, I am pretty sure we talked about the 100% rules there, because they do come up with workers' compensation. People with workers' comp injuries who might not get back to 100%. And we make clear in that guidance that, no, you cannot as an employer have that standard. If somebody with or without reasonable accommodation, in this case with reasonable accommodation, they may not be 100%, but with reasonable accommodation, they can come back to work, they can perform their essential functions, you're going to violate the ADA. So those should not be there. The fix is fairly easy. I mean, if it's a policy, which your question seemed to indicate, those should be amended, that the focus shouldn't be on 100%. The focus can be something like the ability to perform your job, to do it in a competent manner, to do it in a safe manner. You don't have to mention reasonable accommodation, but I think it's a good idea. You know, it reminds people who are implementing the policy, and various people may be implementing it, depending on the employer. You may have workers' comp units or risk management units or individual supervisors and managers, HR people, medical units, again, depending on the employer and the organizational chart. So mentioning reasonable accommodation isn't necessarily a bad idea, but making sure that it's on the ability to do that job, if they can do it with reasonable accommodation, then they should be put back into the position. So I would say that that's still on the books. Employers should move pretty quickly, because the minute, I mean, that's kind of raising a red flag to EEOC, like, you know, putting the red flag in front of a bull. If an EEOC office gets a case involving a 100% requirement to return to work, I guarantee they're going to make that case a priority.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Okay, I have a question here that says, an employee has a trained psychiatric service animal dog and has requested to bring the service animal to the job as an accommodation. She's provided supporting documentation. The employer is refusing, stating that she can take medication that would mitigate her impairment and then would not need the service animal. In your experience, has the EOC investigated any similar complaints of this nature? And do you know if there is any documentation about any similar situations?
I don't know if EEOC has had a similar case. I mean, we are a decentralized agency, meaning, you know, the cases come in all across the country, and they're not necessarily all funneled into my office, and I wouldn't even attempt it because at this point we've got literally now hundreds of thousands of ADA cases. So I cannot definitively say whether we've had this case. I can definitively say that with the information provided, that if it came to the EEOC, this employer is already looking at a potential violation. First of all, employers should never, ever be suggesting medical treatment to an individual. That is so inappropriate on a number of levels. If this is an employer that has its own in-house lawyer or external legal representation, I would think their lawyers are going to go nuts about now. Because if the employee were to, in this example, go on whatever medication, and let's say something happened, something terrible, a very bad reaction, you can bet multi-million dollar damages are going to be filed against the employer on this basis, which is, that alone is a reason I tell employers, is you don't get mixed up in people's medical treatment. You're not to play doctor. Even if you have your own doctors you're consulting with, you should not be. You stay out of it. And then that means the issue is bringing in the service animal. EEOC, in the appendix to its regulations where we talk about different kinds of reasonable accommodations, we do mention in the appendix that it is a form of reasonable accommodation for an employer to allow a service animal on its premises, because normally most employers do not allow their employees to bring animals into the workplace, and so this would be an exception, and as an exception, why? Because it's a reasonable accommodation, the use of a service animal. And if I heard the question correctly, the employee has provided documentation that it is a service animal and how this animal assists the person in terms of their disability. And so at this point, the employer has got to provide a pretty solid reason, in other words, undue hardship, if it says, no, we cannot allow it. And maybe they can. But saying you won't need the animal if you go get a different medical treatment, no. This is an employer at high risk of an ADA violation. So I'm hoping that this can be reconsidered. What I sometimes suggest to employers, if they are reluctant about admitting a service animal, is to do it on a trial basis. That may alleviate some of the employer's concerns. Now, clearly, all service animals need to be kept in the control of the owner. They can't be wandering off. You know, if it's a properly trained service animal, these shouldn't become issues. But obviously, staying under control, not acting aggressively towards anybody else, they can't start barking or what have you. All these kinds of things, what breaks to take the animal outdoors, I mean, all those things can be addressed, but that's the beauty of a trial period, is that it allows the employee to show, look, dog isn't doing anything to anybody else. I'm doing my work as I'm supposed to be doing. And so you can choose, you know, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks to do a trial period. You can address things if anything comes up. And if not, then you don't, you know, you extend it. You just simply say, okay, that you get to bring the animal in as a reasonable accommodation. I'm not saying that an employer should need a trial basis to do it, but what I try to sometimes work out is I want to see if we can ultimately get the accommodation in place. And one of the tools in my toolbox is the trial period. That if the employee really wants this this animal, then what do they have to lose by going along with a trial basis, even if they think that's probably not necessary? But for the employer, it gives them, you know, a chance to see that it works, that they don't feel they have to make a kind of, you know, yes or no decision. So you choose a period of a few weeks as a trial basis. But everything goes right, then trial basis is over, and now, yes, the employer should be granting the accommodation.
Great. Thank you. Big issue, the whole issue of service animals and sex in the workplace and employer resistance and the individualized nature of it is really a key factor. We're getting towards the bottom of the hour, but I do have another question that was submitted electronically that takes us back to the issue of a reassignment, which you had discussed earlier. So this individual is asking, how far does an employer need to go when looking for a vacant position and reassigning someone to that position? So for example, they said, the situation if someone was with a disability was working for a state entity which has many, many positions, departments, divisions, et cetera.
Okay. Again, as Robin said a moment ago, it all becomes somewhat individualized. But when we're talking about state agencies, like the federal government, talking about federal agencies, then probably what you're talking about is the agency where the employee currently works. So for example, if somebody works for the state Department of Revenue, or whatever it may be called along those lines, then you are looking for any vacancy within that Department of Revenue. We're not looking at the Health Department. We're not looking at the Transportation Department. We're looking at the Revenue Department. But we are looking at the entire department. I mean, the fact that somebody works for an agency or an office or division within what's called, and I'm just using Department of the Revenue, you're looking at the entire department of which they are a part. They're an entity within the big entity is the Department of Revenue. So it wouldn't be looking at every single state agency, but rather, in my example, the Revenue Department is what you're going to be looking at. Is probably as far as they have to go. Now, if you're a big enough state, if we are talking, say, Texas or Illinois or California or New York, where you may have district offices or satellite offices, let's stay with the Revenue Department. Okay, so it's not just in the state capital, but we've got satellite offices scattered throughout the state. Well, you'd be looking at all those satellite offices too. The person may currently work in the state capital, but that doesn't mean that you're only looking there. You may be looking at vacancies at satellite or, you know, whatever you call offices in other parts of the state. Now, if you're going to start geographically looking further afield, you definitely want to talk to the individual. If we are, let's say, in California, the state capital, Sacramento, I'm not going to be looking in San Francisco and Los Angeles and San Diego unless I know whether this person is willing to go to those other cities. What's the point? So again, the importance of the interactive process. Don't start looking for vacancies until you have a sense how far does this person want me to look geographically. The same thing is true about looking at other entities. Remember I said, you know, you've not just I work for a particular division or agency or office within the Department of Revenue. I might have to look throughout the entire department. But again, is that of interest to this person? The other issue, what about if we don't have vacancies at that person's level? Most government jobs are usually some kind of grade level or something like that. But suppose we're going to have to look at what would be, in effect, a demotion. We don't have vacancies at one person's level. But do they want me to look at those jobs? And how far down? I mean, they may say, all right, you can look down a couple of grades, but no further than that, because I'm not willing to take that kind of a demotion. On the other hand, I've seen cases where people are like, look, I need to work, and if the closest you have is 10 grades lower than where I am now, I still would like to know about it. I still may seriously consider it. So again, there should be this dialogue with the individual, really getting feedback from them, staying in touch with them as you're doing your search to see how far you want to go, how far they want you to look.
Great. Thank you for your responses on these. We're at the bottom of the hour, and apologize if we've left any questions hanging at this point, but I do want to thank Sharon for her willingness to open herself up to us for any questions that people do want to pose. It's not necessarily the most comfortable position to always be in. You don't know what's coming at you and not necessarily able to prepare in advance, et cetera. But I think we could all tell by the responses and the depth of the dialogue that we had with Sharon today that she has a lot to offer us and that hopefully you got something out of it today. And I really, again, Sharon, appreciate your willingness and taking the time and spending this with last 90 minutes with us and our audience on this particular topic.
It was my pleasure, Robin.
Well, thank you. So at this point, we will conclude today's session. This session was recorded as a reminder, so it will be available within 24 hours as a recording. The edited transcript will be available in approximately 10 days. We do want to draw your attention to the next session of the ADA Audio Conference series. Actually, this is the part of a three-part series, which was starting in January of 2014, running through March of 2014, which is going to focus on the issue of self-evaluation and transition plans. The whole overall series is What's Your Plan? It's a three-part series on self-evaluation, barrier removal, and transition. We'll focus on both Title II and Title III entities as it relates to these issues, because Title III entities have issues related to barrier removal and development of plans as to how they're going to remove those barriers. It's a different context in Title II, but it still has relevance, and we'll be addressing that throughout this series. The first session will be on January 21st, is getting started, and it will feature two speakers, Irene Bowen of ADA One, formerly with the U.S. Department of Justice. She has her own consulting firm now, and Jim Terry from Evan Terry and Associates, who is, again, experienced in the area of providing these services to entities who are developing and implementing self-evaluation and transition plans. So we welcome you to that session and welcome to register for one or more. You will receive an email at the conclusion of this session, which will ask you to fill out an evaluation for us on the session itself, and also advise you as to how you can receive certificates of attendance if you're seeking HRCI from SHRM, et cetera. The instructions will be there as to what you need to do. So again, thank you everyone for your attention today and for your participation. Thank you to our speaker, and we hope everyone has a great holiday season and Happy New Year, and we will see you in 2014, hopefully. So this concludes our session for today. You can hang up your phones, disconnect your computers, and go on your merry way.